because during that fight, Richard Russell's position had become very clear. However much affection Russell might feel for Lyndon Johnson, the overriding reason that Russell wanted him to become president was to protect the interests of the South. When Johnson's interests collided with those interests, it was the South's, not Johnson's, that would be protected. In fact, in the final analysis, it would be only the South's interests that mattered. Aware though Russell might be that Johnson could never become president unless the Senate first disposes of civil rights, if disposing of civil rights entailed Senate actions that hurt the South and the rigid racial segregation that Russell felt was vital to the South, then the disposing would be dispensed with. Use of the filibuster would put an end to Lyndon Johnson's dreams, but the filibuster was the South's ultimate defense. And Russell's firm determination to fight Clint Anderson's motion to the death had demonstrated that he would never agree to any weakening of that defense, no matter how damaging the consequences of such a fight for Johnson's presidential ambitions. Johnson had stood solidly with the South in that fight, but if he hadn't, and if the South had been losing, what would have been the result? Extended debate on 40 separate rules, the most massive filibuster of them all. To advance along his path, Lyndon Johnson had to persuade the Southerners to allow him to distance himself from them on civil rights and from the filibuster that defended civil rights, and in the first test of 1957, the Southerners had shown not the slightest inclination to allow him any real distance at all. With the success of Lyndon Johnson's tabling motion, voices across the entire spectrum of liberal opinion were raised against him. "Once again, democracy has taken a beating in the halls of the United States Senate," the New York Post editorialized. "It was a bad day for the cause of freedom. The unholy alliance of Southern Democrats and Midwestern Republicans still holds sway." And, the Post said, "it holds sway largely because of the majority leader." How can the Democrats explain the continued eminence of Lyndon Johnson, who is justly taking bows for the grand maneuvers of the filibuster legion? The Post's was always one of the shrillest voices in the liberal chorus, but that January there was, in liberal discussions of Lyndon Johnson, a harsh note even in voices that were generally calm and reasonable. In a long, thoughtful analysis of the Senate, Richard Rovere wrote in The New Yorker that one of the institution's most striking aspects is its esprit de corps, which unites senators of differing political views against the world outside the Senate. And proof of this, Rovere said, is the support that Senate Democrats of left, right, and center have given to Johnson. While outside the Senate, among liberal Northern Democrats as a group, it has become an article of faith that Senator Johnson plays a generally destructive role, and that no good can come of his continuing as spokesman for the party. This liberal anger certainly appeared justified. In fighting for the filibuster, Lyndon Johnson had seemingly only been doing in early January 1957 what he had done so many times before. It was only natural for liberals who for 20 years had seen Lyndon Johnson standing squarely on the side of the South and against civil rights to assume that during the rest of 1957 he would be standing on the same side again. But he wouldn't. During Lyndon Johnson's previous political life, compassion had constantly been in conflict with ambition, and invariably ambition had won. Given the imperatives of his nature, in such a conflict it had been inevitable that the ambition would win. For the compassion to be released, to express itself in concrete accomplishments, it would have to be compatible with the ambition, pointing in the same direction. And now, at last, in 1957, it was. So Lyndon Johnson changed, and changed the course of American history. For at last this leader of men would be leading, fighting, not only for himself, but for a great cause. This man who, in the pursuit of his aims, could be so utterly ruthless, who would let nothing stand in his way, who, in the pursuit, deceived, betrayed, and cheated, would be deceiving and betraying and cheating on behalf of something other than himself. Specifically, on behalf of the 16 million Americans whose skins were dark. All through Lyndon Johnson's political life, as congressman and senator, as congressman's secretary and NYA director, there had been striking evidence not only of compassion, but of something that could make compassion meaningful. Signs of a most unusual capacity, a very rare gift, for using the powers of government to help the downtrodden and the dispossessed. This capacity had always been held in check by his quest for power. Now he had the power. Power reveals. The compassion that had been hidden was to be revealed now, in full. Did those 16 million Americans need a mighty champion in the halls of government? They were about to get one. His first job was to persuade Southern senators that they should allow a civil rights bill to pass, that even though they had preserved the filibuster, they shouldn't use it. To persuade them, he employed, in individual conversations with these senators and in meetings of the Southern Caucus in Richard Russell's office, several arguments that his actions on Rule 22 made them more disposed to accept. Some of these arguments were valid. The times were changing, he told them, and we—he always used we in talking with the Southerners, he had been using that pronoun since his We of the South speech in 1949—had better wake up to that. Demand for civil rights legislation was rising. Civil rights was a big issue, and it was going to get bigger, and we look bad on that issue. The Republicans had decided to do anything they had to do to win the nigger vote. He usually used that noun in talking with Southerners, varying its pronunciation to fit the senator. It was nigras with some senators from the Middle South, negras with Eastland or Olin Johnston. The Republicans were making civil rights a party issue, their issue. It's a tough issue for the Democrats. It's hurting us. Look what happened in the last election. Look at that vote in Harlem. And it's hurting us because of what we're doing here in the Senate. The perception is that the Senate is the roadblock, the reason that no civil rights bill has passed in 82 years. And it's easy for Negroes to put the blame on the Senate because we're exposed here. Did you hear what the voters out in Oregon were saying to Dick Neuberger about old Jim? And we're not only weak in the Senate because our Republican friends seem to have suddenly forgotten everything we've done for them, and not only because Bill Noland is going to run for governor of California and he needs the Negro vote. Don't forget who the presiding officer is. Nixon is going to try to out-nigger Noland. He's conniving with the NAACP right now to put us on the spot so we'll look bad. If we don't do something, that issue is going to hurt the whole Democratic Party even worse in 58 and 60. Look what can happen to us in the Senate. All the Republicans have to do is take one seat. One seat. Then it'll be a tie, and Nixon will break it, and we won't even get to organize the Senate again. They will. And the only way to defuse that issue is to let a token bill go through so the Republicans can't say we've stopped all civil rights legislation again. The validity of some of the other arguments he was making to the Southern senators is more difficult to assess. One argument that Johnson made a centerpiece of his case to the Southerners was that we might not even win a filibuster this time, that cloture might be imposed, first because we've got fewer votes. Kefauver isn't going to vote with us, all he can think about is being president, and maybe Gore won't be with us either. That brings us down to 20 votes. And there were other arguments. For a long time, we didn't have to worry about cloture because we could count on the support of the Republicans in the Senate. Now, he said, that support was gone, and we'd better realize that. The whole Republican Party, from the top down, was going to pander to the Negroes. The president will put pressure on the Republican senators, the vice president will, Bill Noland will. And the Republican senators themselves will see the opportunity, not only for the Republican presidential candidate, but for themselves. What are we going to do, Lyndon Johnson asked the Southerners, if one day we go to the Republicans for the rest of the 33 votes we need to sustain a filibuster and the votes aren't there? And the problem wasn't only with the Republicans. The times were changing, he told them. Agitation for civil rights legislation was rising, and therefore pressure on all their Senate colleagues, Democrat as well as Republican, was rising. It was going to be steadily more difficult for non-Southern Democrats to vote with the South. And even if we do stave off cloture this year, he told the Southerners, filibustering this year will hurt us in years to come. There was just too much sentiment out there in the country against filibustering. It's too easy a target. You heard what Nixon said in Harlem. If you support Ike and elect a Republican Senate, you'll get action, not filibusters. Thurmond aide Harry Dent, who had been assigned by Thurmond, more suspicious of Johnson than the other Southern senators, to hang out in the Democratic cloakroom and listen to what LBJ was up to, says that Johnson was arguing that, yes, the Southern leaders had power, but these powers would erode. And Johnson said, if enough Republicans go along with those goddamned bomb throwers in our own party, how can we be sure that cloture won't be imposed? If not in 1958, then in 1959. What if we lose the next vote to table? If Nixon then firms that opinion up into a ruling and the Republicans have the votes to sustain it, what are we going to do then? We might win a filibuster this year, but if we use one this year, then next year or the year after we might lose the whole right to filibuster, might lose it forever. And without a filibuster, the South is defenseless. They can pass any goddamn thing they want. Johnson, Reedy says, was telling the Southerners, don't filibuster. You have to let a civil rights bill pass this year. If you don't, God knows what is going to happen. Another argument he was using was that they shouldn't filibuster because there was no need to filibuster. The Brownell bill might be objectionable, he said, but he said it could be amended. Some of our friends on the other side of the aisle don't like Brownell or his bill any more than we do, he said. There are some people on our side of the aisle who feel the same way, even if they can't say so. These senators, he said, might need to vote for a civil rights bill to satisfy their constituents, but it didn't have to be a strong bill. All these senators were his friends, he said. He could work with them. They would negotiate together. The bill might be a strong bill now, but by the time it came to a vote, it would be a very different bill. It would be amended down until it was so weak that it was only a token bill. They could count on him, he told the Southerners. He would get the bill amended down to something so weak that we have no real objection to it, to something we can live with, and then we won't have to filibuster it. We can let it come to a vote. We'll still vote against it, and if it passes, it won't really matter. We're up against the wall, he told the Southerners. We have to get the best that we can get, and we can get it. The future of the South is at stake here. We have to save the South as much as we can. If we don't do this, let a token bill go through, all the Southern principles will go down the tubes. We can't have everything the way we want it, but we can have most of it. We're up against the wall. And the way to forestall all these unpleasant possibilities of the passage of a law that would transform the Southern way of life, of a defeat of a filibuster this year, of the outlawing of the filibuster in some year to come, was to allow a civil rights bill to go through this year, a weak bill, but a bill, so that the Republicans could not say that the Democrats were standing in the way of any civil rights legislation at all. The validity of these arguments is impossible to evaluate from this distance, for what is involved is the predicting of the votes of individual senators. And so many factors might have influenced the senators that after so many years the votes can't be predicted with any confidence. Even by the most generous estimate, however, those arguments appear to be doubtful. You got up to 33 real fast, Bryce Harlow says, and not only Southern aides, but many observers on the liberal side and the Republican side also agree. A typical comment is that of Sam Zagoria, administrative assistant to the liberal-Republican Clifford Case. The liberals, he said, felt they could win a straight vote, but they felt they couldn't defeat a filibuster. Murray's Weapon, secretary to the Senate parliamentarian, says, down deep, if push came to shove, the liberals wouldn't have had the votes they thought they had. But some of the Southerners didn't count, had never counted. Byrd, for example. Johnson counted for him. And this helped Johnson frighten the Southerners. When he told them that a filibuster might lose, many of them believed him. And some of them were frightened. The Southern way of life was precious to them. How could they gamble it on an uncertainty? Another argument being made to the Southern senators was being made much less explicitly, generally only by implication, only in hints. And it was only occasionally made by Lyndon Johnson. Usually it was made by Richard Russell. For since the argument concerned Lyndon Johnson, at times it was better that it come from someone else. It was a very persuasive argument. The South should let a civil rights bill pass, this argument said, because if it passed, Lyndon Johnson would have a better chance of becoming president. Was Johnson, as Reedy puts it, in private conversations taking advantage of a growing belief that he might be a presidential candidate? When he told Eastland or Olin Johnston or Harry Byrd, I've just got to give those bomb throwers something to get them off my back, did they understand him to be really saying that, as Reedy puts it, he had to have some leeway to get national recognition? that if there was a no-holds-barred fight in the Senate and he lined up on the side of the South, he would never get to be president? When this argument was employed on a Southern senator, implicit in it, of course, was the assumption that a Johnson presidency would be a desirable thing for the South. Johnson and Russell were, in 1957, reassuring Southern senators that this would indeed be the case. With the more senior Southerners, those who had been working with Johnson and Russell for years and who understood the implications of the argument, it wasn't necessary to spell them out or in some cases even to mention them. In 1957, however, there were three new Southern senators, and to them things were made more explicit. Having won a special election in March 1957 to replace Price Daniel, Texas liberal Ralph Yarborough would, on his arrival on Capitol Hill that month, pay the obligatory visit to Richard Russell about his committee assignments, and would be asked by Russell to sign the Southern Manifesto, which had been passed the year before. Yarborough declined and tried to excuse himself by saying that his fellow Texan Johnson hadn't signed. Russell, Yarborough recalls, replied that he, Johnson, was running for president and this signing would ruin him, and that it was important that Johnson not be ruined. Thereafter, listening in the Democratic cloakroom and on the Senate floor to Johnson talk to the other Southern senators, Yarborough understood the reason for Russell's feelings. He, Johnson, made them think he was with them and that he'd be with them forever, Yarborough says. The two other new members of the Southern Caucus, Herman Talmadge and Strom Thurmond, had both been sworn in on January 3, 1957. As soon as Talmadge arrived in Washington, the facts of Senate life were explained to him. Thereafter, he would support Johnson for the presidency, explaining his stand by saying, as a story in the Atlanta Constitution put it, that as president, Johnson would be more favorable to the South's position on states' rights, and therefore his choice would be Johnson. Thurmond, the former presidential candidate of Dixieland's states' right party and an ardent racist, after listening one day in 1957 to the South Carolinian deliver in a dispassionate tone a long dogmatic discourse on the irremediable inferiority of the Negro race, Olin Johnston, ardent racist himself, was moved to comment, "Strom really believes that stuff," was astonished to find that Russell was not adamantly opposed to any civil rights bill at all. He felt he understood Russell's reasoning. "I think Russell didn't fight it, the bill, as hard as he ordinarily would have, if he hadn't wanted Johnson to be president," Thurmond was to tell an interviewer. "He was trying to help Lyndon get elected president." What did this argument mean to the Southern senators? What was Johnson saying to make them feel he would be with them forever? Did it mean, merely, as George Reedy says, that he would use the presidency as a means to heal century-old scars and make the South truly a part of the Union again? That he would end the Civil War? That he would be a bridge for the reconciliation between North and South? Certainly, some of Johnson's aides believe this is the basic meaning. Harry McPherson was to write that Johnson felt about the race question much as I did, namely that it obsessed the South and diverted it from attending to its economic and educational problems, that it produced among white Southerners angry defensiveness and parochialism. And most, if not all, Johnson biographers have believed it too. Johnson argued, and he probably believed, that the South was on the verge of new possibilities for rapid expansion, but that those possibilities would not be exploited if the racial issue was not diffused by civil rights legislation, Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote. And with some of the more tolerant, less racist Southern senators, such as Lister Hill or John Sparkman, that was probably what the argument meant. But did Johnson's persuasion of other Southern senators rest also on other grounds? Probably there is not one answer. Almost certainly there were different emphases depending on which senator he was talking to, arguments tailored to specific individuals by someone supremely gifted at telling each man what he wanted to hear. "We're talking about 20 different individuals, you know," Harry Dent says. But persuasion is in part a matter of tone, and the tone of the words and phrases that Lyndon Johnson was heard using to the Southern senators, the nigger bill, negras, uppity, was not that of a man interested primarily in healing wounds or building bridges or facilitating economic progress. What's more, the Southern Caucus included not only Southern moderates like Hill and Sparkman, but Southern racists like Byrd and Talmadge and Eastland and Olin Johnston, to whom economic progress was not the predominant concern. And these racists were without exception among Johnson's most enthusiastic supporters for the presidency. Johnson was to joke about the depth of Eastland's racial beliefs and about the Mississippians' other obsession, communist subversion. And Johnson's aides and biographers repeat these jokes as if they are evidence of Johnson's true feelings. Writing that Johnson deplored Eastland's militant racism, as well as his communist obsession, Booth Mooney quotes him as saying, "Jim Eastland could be standing right in the middle of the worst Mississippi flood ever known, and he'd say the niggers caused it, helped out by the communists." But until Johnson became president, Eastland did not deplore what he felt were Johnson's beliefs on the issue. There was nothing about Johnson that Eastland deplored. Indeed, this archetypal racist constantly praised Lyndon Johnson in the most laudatory terms. "You have certainly made the best majority leader we have ever had," he wrote him in 1956, adding, "I am leaving tomorrow for the convention and will vote for you for president." And he actively promoted him for the 1960 presidential nomination as well. And Talmadge's statement that the reason he was supporting Johnson was that Johnson would be more favorable to the South's position on states' rights was not a statement about wound healing or bridge building, as became clear when the author, after 10 years of trying to obtain an interview with Talmadge, was finally granted one, which took place on January 10, 2000, at Talmadge's home on Lake Talmadge in Georgia's Henry County, reached by driving south from Atlanta on Herman Talmadge Highway and turning off at the exit marked Herman Talmadge Road. Asked about his relationship with Lyndon Johnson in the Senate, Talmadge said, "At first, for years, I liked him. He spent a lot of time cultivating me, hours and hours." They would talk about everything, Talmadge said. Girls, hunting. And Talmadge said they would talk about civil rights and the relationships between whites and Negroes. How did Lyndon Johnson view the relationship between whites and Negroes? "Master and servant," Talmadge replied. Well, didn't he have any sympathy for their situation? "None indicated," Talmadge replied. Talmadge said that during the 1950s, Johnson would assure the Southerners that they could count on him to weaken a civil rights bill as much as possible, that he was on their side on civil rights, that he had to pretend that he wasn't, to meet the Southern caucus as infrequently as possible, but that he really was their ally. "He would tell us, 'I'm one of you, but I can help you more if I don't meet with you.'" And Talmadge said the Southerners believed him, believed that while changes in the civil rights laws were inevitable, Johnson would keep them as minor as possible, that he was with us in his heart. "I believed him," Talmadge said, "but I changed my opinion." "When?" "When he was president," Talmadge said. "How did you feel then?" "Disappointed," Talmadge said. "Angry." There was a long pause, and then he added, "Sick." When asked, "How did you feel when he said, 'We shall overcome'?" Talmadge repeated, "Sick." The author then asked, "Did you feel that Lyndon Johnson betrayed you?" There was a longer pause. It could not have been easy for a politician as wily as Herman Talmadge to admit he had been fooled so completely. "Yes," he finally said. Of all the top aides to the Southerners, the one with the best view of Johnson's arguments was probably Dent, because of the time he spent keeping an eye on Johnson in the Democratic cloakroom. Dent says, "LBJ's whole gambit was, you guys can put me in the White House, and that will give you more authority and power. And that would keep the South where the South wanted to be, which was a certain amount of segregation at least. He was telling them if LBJ was in the White House, the South would not get everything it wanted, but it would be far better off than if a Hubert Humphrey was president." When Dent's assessment was repeated to John A. Goldsmith, head of the United Press Senate staff in the 1950s, Goldsmith said, "I think it's much more ambivalent than what Dent said. Whether he, Johnson, or Russell would have said it in words that blunt, I doubt." And, Goldsmith said, "that argument was just one of a whole flock of the considerations that Southern senators were taking into account. I think it was one of the things that the Southerners would understand. I have no doubt that Russell conveyed something along these lines to the Southern caucus." And when Goldsmith was asked, "Was Lyndon Johnson in 1957 making them believe that if he became president he would do as much as possible to protect segregation?" Goldsmith replied, "These guys would have taken that as a given." What Lyndon Johnson was saying or hinting about racial segregation during his private conversations with the members of the Southern Caucus, we don't know. We only know the final outcome. Strom Thurmond was suspicious of and unconvinced by Johnson, but the other members of the Southern Caucus were not. Most important, Richard Russell was not. As John Goldsmith has written, Russell's motives have been debated over the years. Russell himself may not have known, in 1957, how much his long-standing, reasoned opposition to all civil rights initiatives was being tempered by his hope that Johnson might succeed in national politics and even become a president attuned to the Southern culture. And, Goldsmith adds, these considerations were not at odds with one another. Russell validated Johnson's arguments by assuring the Southern Caucus that they were true, and he reminded its members of his grand design. It wasn't necessary for Lyndon Johnson to hint to the Southern senators that the South's first priority should be to put him in the White House, because Russell did the hinting. These senators had been following where Russell led for many years now, and they would follow him still. At the end of one Southern caucus in 1957, Harry Byrd summed up the feeling around the huge mahogany table by saying simply, "Dick, it's up to you." Inconceivable as it might seem that these men would allow a civil rights bill, even a very weak bill, to pass, they would allow one to pass if Russell told them to. That same January of 1957, a strange rumor began circulating on Capitol Hill. Clint Anderson was telling friends that Lyndon Johnson had told him that a civil rights bill was going to be passed in 1957, and that he, Lyndon Johnson, was going to support it. Anderson didn't believe either part of that prediction, but it was being heard elsewhere. Report being circulated in Washington that Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson has promised that a civil rights bill will be passed, Roy Wilkins wired to NAACP headquarters in New York. Then the rumor was put in print. The Herald Tribune reported that the Senate's Democratic leadership had reached an understanding to bring the civil rights issue to a head early in the present session. The leadership is hopeful that if it gets the matter to the Senate floor within the next 2 months, any Southern attempt to thwart the decision by extended debate can be beaten down. And there was an even stranger rumor that among the senators to whom Johnson had told this were the Southern senators. In mid-January, reports began to circulate that Russell had convened a secret meeting of the Southern Caucus, and that at that meeting Johnson had laid down a timetable for action on a civil rights bill. And then that timetable was in print. Johnson, Newsweek reported, had told Southerners that floor debate will open in early spring. By the end of April, the bill will be passed. Lyndon Johnson, who as president just a few years later would do so much to end the racial discrimination that was a keystone of the South's way of life, who would do more to end racial discrimination than any other president of the 20th century, was being given a crucial boost toward the presidency by the South's own senators, fervent believers, most of them, in racial discrimination. And at least some of them were helping Johnson at least partly because they believed that while, if he were to become president, he might have no choice but to do something about racial discrimination, they could count on him to do as little as possible. Whether or not Lyndon Johnson was already planning in 1957 to take giant steps toward racial justice if he ever became president, we do not know, and perhaps no one will ever know. But whether or not in 1957 he was misleading the Southern senators deliberately, misled they certainly were. Did he intend to mislead them? We don't know. But if we take him at his word that at Catullah, "I swore then and there that if I ever had a chance to help those underprivileged kids, I was going to do it," then Lyndon Johnson was misleading the Southern senators deliberately. To whatever extent Johnson in 1957 was already planning, at least in outline, the things he would do if he ever became president, he was planning to betray, and to betray on a very large scale, the men, some of them very clever men, who were for years not only his most loyal but his most important supporters. Civil rights didn't get accomplished by idealism but by rough stuff. That was the lesson that Katharine Graham had taken away from her visit to Lyndon Johnson's ranch. What Johnson was doing now with the Southern Caucus, in the service of both his great ambition and his great purpose, was rough stuff indeed. But a civil rights bill had to be passed, and a civil rights bill was going to be passed. His next job, now that he had persuaded the South to let a weak token bill pass, was to reduce the bill to a point at which it was so weak that it was only a token, and yet was still strong enough to satisfy Northern liberals that something genuine had been accomplished for civil rights. That proved to be very difficult. For more than 4 months, in fact, it seemed impossible. The heart of the bill, the part on which both sides were focusing almost exclusively, was its third part, or title, the part covering the broad array of civil rights that would make segregation illegal in schools and in public places such as parks, swimming pools, hotels, motels, theaters, and restaurants. For a while, in mid-January, Johnson seemed to be having some success in persuading the Southerners that the measure would be sufficiently weakened if an amendment was added to provide that anyone indicted for a violation of any of the bill's provisions be entitled to a trial by jury. With a jury trial amendment added, he told them, what would the other provisions matter? They could forego filibustering against the bill because they could be sure, and could excuse themselves to their constituents by explaining, that the other provisions were now meaningless. What white man had to fear a Southern jury? But the bill was simply potentially too destructive to Southern mores for that argument to be convincing. The broadness of its attack on the Southern way of life, the way in which the bill aimed at reducing it to nothing but a memory by mandating an intermingling of the races in so many social settings, infuriated the Southern senators. Part 3 was not only a threat but an insult to their gentle Southland with its friendly, harmonious relations between the races. And Part 3 raised, of course, the specter of that worst of all possibilities, the mongrelization of the noble white race. Adding a jury trial amendment wouldn't be enough. The Southern senators couldn't take a chance that the amendment would vitiate the bill sufficiently. What if federal judges found ways to circumvent that provision? Part 3 was totally unacceptable. It had to go, all of it. None of the senators were angrier than Richard Russell. Among the methods by which Johnson was attempting to influence the Southern caucus was the planting of newspaper articles reporting the understanding among responsible Southerners of the need for passage of civil rights legislation, and of their increased and highly responsible willingness to let the legislation pass if it included the jury trial amendment. But Russell was having none of it. On March 25th, William S. White floated just such a Johnson trial balloon, suggesting the likelihood that a civil rights bill would pass with Part 3 largely intact, but with a provision requiring a jury trial for all violations. Tearing White's articles out of the paper, Russell scribbled across it a note to himself. This story embraces LBJ's ideas and I believe was inspired by him. He talked to me as if this amendment was all we could expect. I don't agree if he will go all out. All out meant removing Part 3 entirely. To the Senate's true civil rights believers, however, Northern liberals of both parties, Part 3 was the most essential part of the bill, the part that made it their dream bill. The most hurtful racial injustices occurred in the very areas in which Part 3 would at last allow the federal government to intervene. Without it, even after Supreme Court decisions, African Americans were still being forced to ride in the back of buses, and black school children still couldn't go to school with white children. The liberals flatly refused to consider the elimination of Part 3, or indeed any substantial alteration in its wording. They refused also to consider any form of a jury trial amendment which would make a mockery of a civil rights bill, whatever its other provisions might be. And joining the liberals in refusal were moderate and even some conservative Republicans who were supporting the unamended bill out of loyalty to the Republican administration which had proposed it, or out of desire for personal political gain. In attempting to reconcile Southern and Northern demands, Johnson was engaging in the search for compromise, for some common ground that is the essence of the legislative process, but on this issue no common ground seemed to exist. For the sake of Johnson's presidential ambitions, for the sake of cleaning him up on civil rights, the South, at Richard Russell's command, might allow civil rights legislation to pass, but only legislation so weak as to be meaningless. Nor was there any reason for it to allow any more. It had in the filibuster an unbreakable defense. In the course of their many private conversations that spring, Merle Miller says, Russell advised Lyndon that the South would not under any circumstances accept Part 3. They would filibuster first, he personally would lead the filibuster, and not only would Lyndon find it very difficult to pass a bill, he would find himself in an extremely ticklish position. Yet when Johnson approached liberals about eliminating Part 3 or substantially modifying it, they refused to consider the suggestion. Nor, they felt, was there any reason for them to consider it. At last, after so many years of frustration, they had Republicans on their side, and therefore had the votes to pass a civil rights bill. They were determined to pass one that was truly meaningful, which meant passing one that included Part 3. And there was an additional, less altruistic motive: revenge. Frustration had done peculiar things to the psychology of the Northern civil rights advocates, George Reedy was to say. The feeling of impotence was preying on their mind. There was a distinct note of retribution in their voices, and it was apparent that they wanted something more than a civil rights bill that would help blacks. They wanted a bill that would include every civil rights concept that had been concocted in over a half a century, and they wanted to rub Southern noses in it. Watching Johnson search vainly for a compromise, Reedy felt that everything had been said that could possibly be said, with the only result the hardening of positions and increasing polarization of attitudes, and that movement in any direction was impossible because the question was not being treated as a legislative matter. Instead, it was a clash between the mores of two cultures, deep-seated moral beliefs that could not be compromised. At the start of the four-month period, beginning in mid-January 1957, optimistic predictions had been the order of the day. The fact that the margin for Lyndon Johnson's tabling motion had been only 17 votes was hailed by civil rights advocates, the New York Times reported, as historic and a landmark that would strengthen liberal chances tremendously at the opening of future Congresses. "We got 38 votes for it," Howard Schuman exulted. "In 1953, we only got 21. If Nixon turned his opinion into a ruling in 1959, only 49 votes would be necessary to defeat tabling and to rewrite Rule 22. And suddenly that figure seemed within reach. Declaring that we made very real gains, an elated Paul Douglas said, "We'll win either next time or the time after." This view was shared by the press, which, like Douglas, ignored Russell's threat that a ruling to allow the rewriting of Senate rules would be followed by the rewriting of not one rule but 40. Nixon's opinion, Time said, raised an emotional floodgate for a piece of vital legislation that had been dammed too long by Senate rules. Newsweek's Sam Schaffer agreed. "The generation-old coalition of Southern Democrats and certain Northern Republicans in Congress lies in ruins," he said. "And with their former allies defecting from the ranks, the final vote in the Senate revealed the Southerners in a position hopelessly untenable." Their victory on the tabling motion had been pyrrhic, Schaffer said. As they surveyed the field of victory, they saw that, in truth, they had lost. On January 21st, the Brownell Bill, essentially the same bill guaranteeing a broad range of civil rights that had been submitted in 1956, was returned to Capitol Hill. Liberal senators, liberal strategists, columnists of all persuasions, and most of the Washington press corps agreed that this year the bill would pass. "The Southerners will try their old tactics," Time predicted, "but this time, with liberals and Republicans united against the South, those tactics will fail. There should be enough sympathetic votes to force the bill out of the Judiciary Committee lorded over by Chairman Eastland. Before Congress adjourns, everyone agreed, there will be a sizzling Senate filibuster. But this time the filibuster will be broken. When some 20 die-hard Southern senators attempt to talk the bill to death on the floor, there should be enough votes even under present cloture rules to cut off the filibuster and bring the measure to a vote. And then at last," Time said, "a tiny band of Southerners who over the years have combined seniority and archaic rules to strangle legislation that displeased them will have suffered momentous defeat." The optimism was shared by the Republican leaders in Congress, as is shown by the typed summary of their weekly meeting with President Eisenhower on January 8th. According to the summary, an unidentified participant said, "Civil rights has to go early if to get it." But the president was assured by House GOP leader Joseph Martin that there would be no trouble getting early action on the Brownell bill. "Republicans and Democrats want to get that bill out," Martin said. If it came up first in the Senate, he said, there would be fast action. "If Noland calls it up, pass quick, only 25 votes against. And as Martin indicated to reporters, if it came up first in the House, action would be even faster. There was no question, he said, that the House would approve the bill in about 2 days. Joining in the assurances, Noland stated that this year there would not be the usual delays in the Senate, in part because of the cooperation of the Democratic leader. I talked with Johnson, he had told Eisenhower during the meeting. I told him if they, the Democrats, do not take it up, I intend to. He was agreeable and he's served notice on the Southerners. Back at the Capitol, he was equally sanguine. Inviting Clarence Mitchell to his office, he unequivocally promised the NAACP lobbyist that if the South tried to filibuster, he would personally lead and win the fight for cloture. A filibuster could delay a civil rights bill, he told a reporter for the Congressional Quarterly. It couldn't stop it. The customary route to the Senate floor, of course, was through a Senate committee, and the liberals set out along this route, and at first they felt they were making good progress. Tom Hennings was brimming with confidence. His bill, similar to Brownell's, had already been reintroduced and referred to the Senate Judiciary Committee. He himself was chairman of Judiciary's three-man subcommittee that had jurisdiction over civil rights bills, but, he explained to reporters, hearings in that subcommittee would be unnecessary since it had already favorably reported the same bill to the full committee last year. Therefore, Hennings said, the full committee, 8 of whose 15 members were, after all, strong civil rights supporters, could start holding hearings so early that Eastland's delaying tactics would not work. Noland agreed. The committee can have hearings while the House is working and get it reported by the time the House acts, the Republican leader said. I'd like to start by mid-Feb or late-Feb on civil rights. And once the bill got to the Senate floor, the delaying tactics of the past would not be successful. Not only Hennings, but other senators assured reporters of that. There is a belief that a filibuster now could be broken despite past failures, John D. Morris reported in the New York Times. And, the Times said, in part this belief was based on the cooperation of the majority leader. The Senate's Democratic leadership has reached an understanding to bring the civil rights issue to a head early in the present session. The leadership is hopeful that if it gets the matter to the Senate floor within the next 2 months, any Southern attempt to thwart the decision by extended debate can be beaten down. And then the reality of the Senate took hold, the reality of Henry Cabot Lodge Sr. and the Foreign Relations Committee when Woodrow Wilson had been trying to win approval of the League of Nations, the reality of the Judiciary Committee when Franklin D. Roosevelt had been trying to win approval of his court reorganization bill. The reality that was still the reality. Hennings's confidence about quick subcommittee and committee action lasted only until Judiciary's first meeting, on January 22nd, at which there were some developments he had not anticipated. It was a chairman's prerogative to appoint the members of his committee's subcommittees, and Chairman Eastland now read off the names of the members of Hennings's subcommittee, and there were no longer three names but seven. The chairman had added to it four new members, Southerners Olin Johnston and Sam Ervin, and conservative Republicans Roman Hruska and Arthur Watkins. Olin the Solon said that, of course, there would have to be extensive subcommittee hearings on the civil rights bill for the benefit of the new members, and the other new members agreed with that. At the subcommittee's first meeting, on January 30th, Hennings tried to persuade its members to agree to a 2-week limit on hearings. The two holdover members voted with him, making 3 votes in favor of the proposal. The 4 new members voted against it. Emerging from the subcommittee room after the meeting, Hennings told reporters he was very disappointed, but that he would still press for early action, holding long hearings if necessary. Long hearings? Hennings was asked. Was he saying that the subcommittee would meet while the Senate was in session? Did he have the Senate's permission to do that? Senate permission was required for subcommittees as well as committees, he was reminded. Hennings then applied on the Senate floor for unanimous consent for the necessary permission. Do I hear any objection? The presiding officer asked. It turned out he heard several objections, all in Southern accents. And the subcommittee's favorable report would not be reported to the full committee until March 19th. And of course, that report was not to the Senate, but only to the parent committee, Judiciary. Jim Eastland's Judiciary. After interviewing Eastland, a young reporter, 28-year-old Tom Wicker of the Winston-Salem Journal, wrote that the soft-spoken man propping his gouty foot on the big cluttered desk doesn't seem to mind that he had become a byword for prejudice. And when he asked Eastland about the liberals' plans to hurry the bill through judiciary, the chairman said, "It's not going to be as easy as they thought, old scout." The chairman was correct. Every time Hennings attempted to bring up his report for committee action, Eastland recognized another committee member instead, usually one of its three other Southerners. Judiciary's once-a-week meetings began every Monday at 10:30 a.m., and at 12 noon the Senate bells rang to signal the beginning of the day's session, the time at which Senate rules required the adjournment of committee meetings. Eastland enforced the rule to the minute, and one of the Southerners was almost always still holding the floor, with Hennings still unheard when the bell rang. Once, Hennings actually got to start reading his resolution, but the bell rang before he finished. Before its echo had died away, Eastland had rapped his gavel for adjournment. And, of course, should the bill ever emerge from judiciary, it would still have to face the Senate itself. Judiciary might, of course, be bypassed if the Senate took up a House-passed version of the bill instead, but unanimous consent was required for the Senate to do that. A Washington Star reporter asked Russell whether, in the light of public and Republican support for civil rights, there was any prospect that the South might be willing to compromise its stand against the passage of any civil rights legislation whatsoever and allow a House bill to be taken up. "Compromise," Russell said. "I will not compromise in the slightest degree where the constitutional rights of my state and her people are involved. I am well aware of the fact that there is great political pressure for the passage of these misnamed civil rights bills," he said. "But if they reach the floor in their present form, they will be vigorously resisted by a resolute group of senators." And those senators, he promised, would insist that the Senate follow orderly procedure. Orderly procedure, of course, included extended debate. Writing his story, the reporter put on it a lead that summed it up. "Senator Russell, Democrat of Georgia, yesterday threw down the gauntlet to advocates of civil rights legislation who contend this is their victory year." The North wanted the legislation in essentially its present form. Russell was saying that if the legislation reached the floor in its present form, there would be a filibuster. And whatever its result, a filibuster would wreck Lyndon Johnson's chance for the Democratic presidential nomination. Observers who felt that Russell was short on allies, moreover, were overlooking one they seemed to overlook every year. Russell was indeed on the defensive on Capitol Hill now, seemingly beaten as Lee had been on the defensive in 1865, with Grant pressing him back and back. Even as Lee devised one stratagem after another, he had been aware that they were only delaying actions that could postpone but not avert defeat. There was, however, a crucial difference between the strategic situations facing the two great Southern generals. For in war there is no time limit, no deadline at which, if neither side has won, a final armistice is declared. Robert E. Lee had not had time on his side. Time was on Richard Brevard Russell's side, though. For him, delay would not necessarily end in defeat. Delay could, in fact, be the means of victory. Victory at least for another year or for another two-year Congress, and perhaps for many Congresses to come. For there was a time limit on Capitol Hill. Each Congress is only 2 years long, and a bill that has not been passed at the end of 2 years dies and must start over from scratch in the next Congress. It must be reintroduced, must renegotiate all the preliminary committee procedures in both houses, must be passed by both houses. During the 1950s, in addition, the actual time available to pass a bill was far less than 2 years because it was only in wartime that Congress met for a full year each year. Usually, its sessions were considerably shorter. Of the 23 peacetime annual sessions since 1933, when Congress had begun convening in January, exactly one had lasted as long as the end of August, 8 months. Many had ended in June or July. And because of the holiday recesses Congress awarded itself, a traditional week in February for Lincoln's birthday, another few days in February for Washington's birthday, 10 or 11 days for Easter, additional vacations for Memorial Day and the 4th of July, Numerous pro forma Monday and Friday sessions at which most congressmen were traveling back and forth from their districts. Even 8 months actually meant far less. If a controversial bill, one entailing lengthy hearings and intra-committee fights and perhaps floor battles as well, was to be passed, it had to begin moving through the congressional committee processes rather early. In the case of a bill controversial enough to possibly provoke a filibuster, an early start was indispensable for another reason as well. If such a bill was brought to the Senate floor late in the session, too close to the time when the Senate was rushing toward adjournment and senators were anxious to go home, the prospect of fighting a filibuster out to the end, no matter how many weeks or months it takes, was particularly unappealing. Pressure to end the matter, to simply drop the bill, was intensified. If you wait too long, George Reedy explains, then what happens is that the looming end of the session becomes a weapon to be used by the filibusterers. So delay was a potent weapon. On a legislative battlefield, delay could mean victory. This was understood on Capitol Hill in 1957. Has to go early if to get it, the White House had been told. There was even an understanding of how early it had to go, that unless the Civil Rights Bill reached the Senate floor by the Easter vacation in mid-April, or at the very latest by the early part of May, there would be almost no hope of passing it over a Southern filibuster. But there had been confidence among Republican leaders that this year it would go early. The Senate Majority Leader was agreeable, and he served notice on the Southerners. Noland had spoken of getting the Civil Rights Bill to the floor by mid-Feb or late Feb. But that had been in January, when Russell and Johnson had optimistically felt the bill might be made sufficiently meaningless so that the South could let it pass. Now, in February and March and April, Russell was using delay as a weapon. Years later, when he was president, Johnson would explain to Katherine Graham how civil rights bills had invariably been defeated by delay on Capitol Hill. They'd come back about the 18th of January, and then they'll have hearings in the House Rules Committee till about the middle of March, and then they'll pass the bill, and it will get over, and Dick Russell will say, "It's Easter and Lincoln's birthday," and by the time you get him, he will screw them to death because he's so much smarter than they are. Now, in 1957, Russell was screwing them to death in the way that Johnson described to Mrs. Graham, screwing them again, as he had in the past, by delay. And in February and March and April of 1957, it was beginning to become apparent that in the use of this weapon, the South and Russell were being assisted by the Senate Majority Leader. In January, Lyndon Johnson had assured the Southerners that he would be able to make the Civil Rights Bill meaningless enough so that they could live with it, but he had been unable to deliver. Russell's price for foregoing a filibuster, the excision of the broad array of civil rights guarantees and the emasculation of the remaining provisions by the right of jury trial, was payable only in non-Southern votes for those Southern demands. Johnson had been unable to meet that price, had been unable to find those votes. The irresistible force of civil rights demands was indeed colliding with an immovable object, and Johnson had seemingly decided simply to step out of the way. During those months, he was no less agreeable to Noland than he had been in January. He just wasn't as active. No more was heard of the January understanding to bring the civil rights issue to a head early, to get it to the Senate floor within the next 2 months. And those actions that Lyndon Johnson did take spoke louder than words. To delay the attack on a stronghold, a citadel, the defenders try to fight first on its outskirts. During those days of Lyndon Johnson's agreeability, there had been discussion, even optimism, among Republican leaders that he might in effect forego that delaying action by allowing the battle to begin in the Citadel itself, by allowing the Civil Rights Bill to be taken up in the Senate first. Now, however, Johnson repeated what he had said in 1956, that the Senate would not take up the bill until after the House had passed it. To ensure that flanking movements against the Citadel itself were not launched against his wishes, he was employing another tactic. This was a traditional Southern tactic, one whose repeated use over the years had not dulled its effectiveness. It was simply to delay consideration of other major bills while waiting to take up the Civil Rights Bill. If all the other major bills had been taken up, then by the time the Civil Rights measure arrived on the floor, precipitating a filibuster, it would be the only major piece of unfinished Senate business. But if other major bills remained to be disposed of at the time a filibuster brought Senate activity to a halt, these bills would become weapons in the Southerners' hands. Other senators would realize that if the Civil Rights Bill was not dropped, if the Southerners were not allowed to win, if instead the Senate decided to fight it out on the filibuster front as long as it took and not move on to other business, that other necessary legislation might not be taken up. Therefore, as Reedy explains, if you know you've got an issue coming up that is going to start a filibuster, you try to get those other important bills out of the way. Otherwise, senators will say, "My God, we're holding up this other bill." A leader who wants a filibuster to lose always tries to get the desks cleared before the filibuster comes up. A leader tries to clear the decks early in the year, in fact, before the looming end of the session made the many senators who didn't particularly care about civil rights say, as the civil rights bill approached, "Don't bring it up, otherwise we'll never get to the other important bills." Lyndon Johnson was not doing this. The Eisenhower administration had a list of legislation it considered essential. Not only its big school construction program, but a law to provide federal aid to chronically depressed communities. Authorization for United States participation in the Organization for Trade Cooperation, and a badly needed increase in postal rates to cover a rapidly worsening deficit in the Post Office Department. In addition, with Egypt's President Nasser stalling on reopening the Suez Canal, Israel stalling on withdrawing its troops from the Gaza Strip, and the threat of Russian intervention escalating, Eisenhower had asked for a congressional resolution giving him advance authorization to intervene economically or militarily in the Middle East, authorization Eisenhower considered vitally necessary to deter Russia, since, with modern war perhaps a matter of hours only, there might not be time to go to Congress if an attack occurred. At an extraordinary meeting of 30 congressional leaders of both parties at the White House on New Year's Day, Eisenhower had stressed the need for rapid approval, as he did in a special message he delivered in person on Capitol Hill 5 days later. Although there were differences within the Senate on the resolution's wording, general agreement existed that some form of authorization was desirable. The situation was precisely the kind on which Lyndon Johnson had, so many times, worked out a unanimous consent agreement. No such agreement was brought forward now, however. Week after week, the debate on the Middle East resolution dragged on, tying up the Senate before a notably empty chamber and a scene out of the Senate's pre-Johnsonian foot-dragging past, complete with legalistic nitpicking. "I am waiting for the opposition point of view to provide some answers before I proceed to rebuttal and sir-rebuttal and rebuttal of the sir-rebuttal," Wayne Morse announced at one point. He was not kidding. And senatorial frustration. "Why cannot we vote?" Dennis Chavez shouted one day. "I am ready to vote now." Eisenhower's other essential legislation also remained stalled behind the resolution. Until that resolution was out of the way, the Senate would not be able to turn to the other administration priority bills and get them out of the way. Slow as is the first year of most Congresses, this was slowness indeed. And the foot-dragging had a special significance this year. "The 85th Congress has been in session now for 6 weeks," the New York Herald Tribune noted on February 14th, "and the civil rights issue, which was to have been the burning question at hand, has been pushed into the background by the Senate debate over President Eisenhower's Mideast policy." When the Senate finally voted, it adopted the original resolution, 72-19, but that vote was not taken until March 5th. Johnson had said the Senate would not act on the civil rights bill until the House acted, and House action was not, in fact, coming in about 2 days. The tone of the Republicans' weekly White House legislative conference began to change. At the January 8th meeting, Noland had predicted that the Judiciary Committee would report the bill to the Senate floor by mid-Feb or late Feb. In the summary of Noland's report to the next meeting, held on January 22nd, a new month is being mentioned. Hope to get it out by late February or early March. A week later, on January 29th, the minutes start mentioning Easter, a holiday which falls not in March but in April. Every effort will be made to secure action on the legislation prior to any Easter recess. Speaker Martin noted the appearance of some sign of a Democratic desire to delay action. Eisenhower was moved to muse, "Strange, years ago we talked about the same things." The minutes of the March 12th meeting show that reality was beginning to penetrate even the densest material. Senator Nolan said that if the president's moderate proposal is to be achieved, then there was a need to get it moving soon. He had to report, however, that the opposition had told him that if Republicans insisted on moving on civil rights, there would be some other legislation that would automatically be lost. And the minutes of the March 26th meeting summarize an exchange between Noland and Halleck which shows further penetration. Noland, if we are to get it, must get before last stages. Halleck, think you're too late already. Noland, not yet, but close. On April 2nd, Senator Nolan thought the Democrats seemed to be dragging hard on this. They did not even want a committee report to come out until after the Easter recess. Senator Dirksen chimed in that there was a problem in committee. There was a problem, all right. The report of Hennings's subcommittee had finally reached the full Judiciary Committee. The morning of April 1st, in fact, Chairman Eastland would actually recognize Hennings and allow him to make a motion that the committee take a final vote on the measure by April 15th. The reason for Eastland's generosity then became apparent. While he had allowed Hennings to make the motion, he would not allow the committee to vote on it. It would be patently unfair, he said, for the committee to vote before it had studied the transcript of the subcommittee's hearing. He had inquired of the Senate printing office, the chairman said, as to when that transcript would be available, and it would not be ready for 2 weeks. And, the chairman added, subcommittee member Irvin had notified him that he wanted to write a minority dissent to its report, and that he would not be able to begin writing until he had studied the transcript. Hennings's motion, Eastland said, would therefore not be in order. At the White House on April 9th, a new month was mentioned in the discussion on civil rights. Senator Noland again pointed to Democratic foot-dragging and their apparent determination to keep the subject off the floor until mid-May so that other legislation may then take priority. That long a delay would probably kill the bill, Noland said. He thought the Republicans would have to put on a drive to get earlier action than that if any bill is to be forthcoming this year. If the Republicans are to get a bill, they must make major